Special thanks to NBC Universal. The Breakfast Club is available for purchase digitally or via Blu-ray DVD. This is a Hot Pie original.
The Meyer Chronicles, take one. Welcome to The Meyer Chronicles, a Hot Pie Media production. For more information about The Meyer Chronicles, go to hotpiemedia.com. In this episode, Andy Meyer and John Rubin discuss the making of the classic 80s film, The Breakfast Club. This is part two of two.
Hi, I'm Andy Meyer. Welcome to the Making of the Breakfast Club podcast, part two. And I'm here with my friend, John Rubin. He's a cool guy, and he knows more about the Breakfast Club than anybody I know, except me. And we're going to have a little chat, talk about the marketing of the movie. Hi, John.
Hey, Andy. Pleasure to be here again. Great to do another podcast with you. Of course, Andy has an illustrious career, you know, 30 plus years experience in the entertainment industry, on the film side, on the music side, executive producer of the films Fried Green Tomatoes, Bring on the Night, Better Off Dead, one of my favorites, Birdie, and of course, The Breakfast Club. So let's talk about what's happening here in the fall of 1984, where shooting has wrapped on The Breakfast Club. You guys have seen cuts about it. Universal was very nervous about how to market this film. Andy, why was that?
Well, the problem the studio was having in those days was they're very good, and the same thing is true now, is they're very good at sending 4,000 prints around and doing a massive campaign for a franchise movie. To handle a character piece that is neither a pure comedy or a pure drama was a mystery to them, and they didn't know how to handle it, and they didn't know how to platform it in a way to monetize the film properly. And they were nervous about one sequence, which we talked about in part one, the 20-minute talking head sequence in which everybody sits on the floor and reveals why they're really in detention.
I'm here because Mr. Ryan found a gun in the locker.
And the studio felt it was way too serious, way too long. In those days, there weren't movies like this where kids talked about their feelings and they wanted to figure out a way to get rid of it or change it. And John and I went bananas, basically, and said, you have to give us a chance to show this 20-minute sequence to an audience. It's just not fair to arbitrarily cut it out.
That's John Hughes, of course, the writer and director of The Breakfast Club.
John Hughes. And so in John's deal as a director, when there's a dispute, the Directors Guild contractually allows you a certain number of screenings to prove your point, to have them not change your cut, although John didn't have final cut. So we decided that we needed to test the picture and we needed to convince the studio that this 20-minute sequence was important and they shouldn't either shorten it or get rid of it.
My God, are we gonna be like our parents?
And the way that process works is you take the picture, usually outside of LA where the quote, real people are. I never understood what that meant, like Phoenix or something like that. And
they're real people in Phoenix.
Yeah, so you show the print, you have somebody come in afterwards with what's called the focus group, and he asks a lot of questions and you fill out a lot of cards. And when the cards came in, everybody loved the movie and everybody thought it was really both a comedy and a drama. And their favorite scene in the movie was the 20-minute talking head sequence, which the studio wanted to get rid of, which proves William Goldman's point that nobody knows anything, that famous line from his book.
I hate it. I hate having to go along with everything my friends say.
So I'm sure you and John were high-fiving, saying, all right, people are getting this. We're not crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were really nervous, especially when they wanted to. I mean, the heart of the movie is that 20-minute talking head scene, and they were trying to cut the heart out.
So now the studio says, all right, this is resonating with our test audiences. This stays in the film. So you had said to me, though, that really because Ned, you know, he was the president of Universal just before branching off to Channel Productions. If he didn't, you know, the muscle and clout he must have had to protect this film, how much of this would you attribute to Ned Tannen's clout in the industry that you guys were sort of able to protect the movie as it was?
Well, I think a lot, but it was more of a collective thing because John by then and Ned had made 16 Candles. And John wanted to make more movies, and Ned wanted to make more movies with him. And we were part of that mix. So John was so hot that, you know, you'd have to be really an idiot in retrospect, as I'm thinking about it, to like come in, take out his favorite scene in a movie with the hottest guy in Hollywood right now. It just doesn't make sense. But at the time you're doing something, you're so inside it, you don't step back with that perspective that I have now 35 years ago. But at the time, you're like, you know, you're talking to these people, they're nervous, you're meeting with the marketing guys, and the marketing guys are showing you different ads for comedies and dramas, and it's like you're in a tunnel. And that's what it was like in those days.
And I know there were lots of different trailers, right, that they were cutting to show you guys. And tell me about some of what you guys were seeing and why the trailers really weren't, you know, reflective of what the film really was at first.
Because they were either all mostly all comedy,
right,
to make it look like a teenager, you know, fun flick. And they were really afraid to be too dramatic because they didn't think that's commercial. And they wanted it to look more like 16 Candles because 16 Candles was, you know, the first movie. And
that was a hit.
Yeah, and it was a hit, but you can never fool an audience, really. And audiences get mad if they look at a trailer and they think it's one thing, and then they go see the movie and it's something else, and you feel like you've been tricked into seeing something, and you're pissed off. And that, you know, that's reflected in word of mouth, and if you're doing focus groups, and they just couldn't find the right balance. Fortunately, when we previewed the picture, the picture sold itself. Everybody was talking about it. The reviews were fantastic. People really respected the multi-leveled diversity of thought that was in the movie, different kids from different backgrounds, how they mixed together. It was just something people hadn't seen before. And that's why, you know, 35 years later, we're still talking about it. It's as relevant now as it was then.
Let's listen to one of those trailers now, because it is, you're right, it's goofy, it's comedy, it's really not what the movie is. Check this out.
The Breakfast Club. They only met once.
I don't want to be alone anymore.
You don't have to be.
But it changed their lives forever.
I mean, I consider you guys my friends. I'm not wrong, am I?
Let me ask you, part of the marketing to me that I think was really huge was getting that classic, iconic photo from Annie Leibovitz to be as the face of the movie poster. How did that come about?
That was Universal. By the way, the new Wonder Woman movie, 1984, copied that Annie Leibovitz poster for their movie. So that, you know, iconic poster has lasted a long time in various generations and in various forms. But Universal hired Annie. It was kind of a brave move because she had done such iconic work to basically shoot a couple of unknown kids. It was smart. I think Ned had a lot to do with that, actually.
Yeah, and it was right before she exploded. So, you know, you guys got her right in time.
Right.
So you've got this great movie poster, and now we got to talk about the soundtrack. At what point did you hear the song Don't You Forget About Me, recorded by Simple Minds, for the soundtrack, for the marketing of this film? This was going to be the song that was going to kick off this film and end the film. When did you hear that song and what did you think of it?
I heard it with David Anderle probably early in the production because John had a lot of music that he would play and keep. But, you know, that song and that soundtrack really helped define the movie in a different way than most of these kind of teenage pictures. I mean, the words matter. Words don't always matter in a song, but they matter in this song. And John had a way of always telling a story about somebody's character, about who they were. And that song did that.
So let's go to opening night in Westwood. Okay. It's February 15th, 1985, and the Breakfast Club is about to be unleashed on the world.
Well, well, here we are.
Tell us what that first night was like and your experience in the theater, watching it for the first time with a real audience.
Well, it was sold out, which was nice, you know. And Ned and I stood in the back for the entire movie. We didn't sit down at all. And John came in and out. He was nervous and didn't really want to see the whole thing. So he would sort of go back and forth. But we were watching the audience. We were watching the film. What was really heartwarming to us is all the laugh lines were working.
Does Barry Manilow know that you raid his wardrobe?
All the intensity of the drama was working.
You think I don't understand pressure, Claire?
The audience was getting what John wanted them to get and Dee Dee Allen wanted them to get. And it was just a wonderful experience, terrifying before the movie. I mean, you never know how a movie's going to play until you get an audience in there and show it to them.
Why are you being so nice to me? Because you're letting me?
You can, you know, look at dailies, you can look at rough cuts, you can have focus groups, but it's the real audience that is that moment of reckoning.
And of course, the 20-minute group therapy scene that focus groups reacted to, I'm sure that audience was sort of entranced by that whole scene as well, yeah?
I looked at it recently because I show it, you know, to my students. It still plays well. I mean, the beats really work. How John moves from intense drama to a quick joke and a laugh to get out of the scene. It's really good performing and really good directing and acting, I think.
So would you say that at opening night, you know, you guys, you and Ned are watching the audience, but you're really watching each other. And then you're seeing this is working, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're in the back. We were too nervous to sit. And we were looking at all different kind of demographics. It was mostly young people, but there were also a lot of studio people there, entertainment people, because it was Westwood in LA, which is, you know, the heart of Hollywood. And from the beginning opening to the end, it really played well. That iconic fist bump that Judd Nelson does at the end got such a cheer, and everybody's like clapping and happy. The most That's awesome. Important part of a movie from a business point of view is the ending of the movie. How the audience feels when they walk out of a movie is the most important part of selling the movie. You want to build them to a place where they're texting their friends right away when the movie's over, and they want to go back again another time, and they want to know everything they can about it. And the only way you get that is with a great ending, and The Breakfast Club had a great ending.
For sure, for sure. I mean, the way that scene says it all at the end, the way they open up to each other, and, you know, they really realize that they're actually a lot more similar than they thought they were when they first walked in that room.
But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain and an athlete
and a basket case, a princess
and a criminal.
Tell us about, like, the word of mouth that you saw happening after opening night.
Well, reviews were important in those days, and they're not really that important anymore. But getting a good review in Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and the New York Times and the LA Times was really, you had publicists. I don't think there are publicists anymore, you know, doing that kind of work with reviewers. They probably do it for social media.
Yeah, exactly.
But you were waiting for, I used to get the papers, the Variety and Hollywood Reporter delivered to my door. So, you know, at like 5 a.m. So the night of the premiere, you know, I'm up at 3 waiting for the, it wasn't online. the physical paper had to arrive at your door.
What's
and
that?
Then I would take physical? It and drive it over to Gil Friesen's house and show it to him at 6 a.m. And it was like the old days of the mailman delivering a telegram or something like that.
Right, right.
And all the reviews were good. Pauline Kael, one of our most famous reviewers at the time, gave it a fabulous review. And for, you know, a first-time director, second-time director, he had a lot of respect at that time, both as a writer and as a director, primarily because of The Breakfast Club as a director, not necessarily 16 Candles, which was viewed in kind of a different category of directing excellence. 16 Candles, from a director's point of view, worked because it was commercial. The Breakfast Club, from a director's point of view, was well respected and was commercial.
Yeah. Well, that's the irony, is that smaller picture with, you know, one room and essentially five cast members is actually the harder film to direct than a large movie with a big cast and multiple locations. It's funny how that works. You know, you talked about good reviews, which I knew were much more important then, and the movie did get a lot of acclaim. But what was the thing that was most personally sort of validating for you?
Well, that my instinct was right, that I read something. I didn't do any research. I didn't even give it to anybody else to read except for Herb and Jerry and Gil. You know, it gave me confidence that I could look at something and I had the chops to decide if it was worth doing.
And also I figure, you know, all your friends and family, people are probably calling you in those weeks, telling you what they thought of the movie right after. I mean, that was a big thing as well, right?
Well, there's nothing better than having somebody come up to you and say, you made my day. Thank you for making The Breakfast Club. You know, I've been getting it for years, especially from students who still want to hear some stories about it. And I travel all over the world from the Savannah College of Art and Design, meeting with students. I've shown The Breakfast Club all over the world. I've shown it in Beijing. I've shown it in Buenos Aires. I've shown it in Santiago, Chile. And they've all seen the movie. They all know the movie.
Wow.
It's subtitled in Portuguese.
How do you say Neo Maxi Zoom Dweeby in Portuguese?
I don't know. But it's also in Mandarin, so in China. So,
oh, wow.
It has not only stood the test of time, I think each generation sees something a little different in it from their own point of view, from their cultural point of view. But its universal theme is extraordinary.
Let's talk about that theme and why that has resonated, you know, through multiple generations and you know, around the world, like you said. Like, what is it about what John Hughes created with these characters that is evergreen?
I think what John saw in his high school years is that everybody puts some kind of a shield around them and pretends to be something that they're probably not. And they're afraid for people to perceive who they are as a person, because it can be very sensitive and honest. And this movie just folds back all the levels of protection that you have being a jock or a princess. And at the end, it gets down to who they really are. You know, the question I'm always asked about The Breakfast Club is one that's asked in the movies. Do you think they would have all gotten together that next Monday in school? And nobody knows the answer to that, and everybody's a different opinion. But that question's raised in the third act of the movie, that fight they have. Would they talk to each other if they saw each other in the hall? But to be able to leave the movie with that kind of a question mark, it sort of says that the movie's never finished.
What is going to happen to us on Monday when we're all together again? I mean, I consider you guys my friends. I'm not wrong, am I?
The other question I get is, could you do a sequel? Well, I had talked to Universal about doing a sequel at one point, but I think everybody felt it's so unique and original that you'd not only screw it up, but you would devalue the original Breakfast Club film, and it's better to keep it the way it is. I have a real talent for making films that can't be sequels. Fried Green Tomatoes, there's no sequel. Breakfast Club, there's no, I don't even know if that's good or bad. But that's my skill. Better Off Dead, there's no sequel.
It's funny when you look at, not a sequel, but what if a remake were to be made of The Breakfast Club? You know, I know we've joked about, like, what would that look like?
Well, if there was a remake, there wouldn't be a Breakfast Club because they'd just be texting each other. There wouldn't even be any dialogue. They would just be sitting in a classroom texting each other.
Is that why it's strange when, you know, somebody younger today might look at the movie and they think, wow, these people, they're so bored for 9 hours. There's nothing to do. Well, a kid today would never survive that, ever.
Yeah, fortunately, it's more universal than that. But, you know, I think if the movie came out now, I think it would come out on Amazon or Netflix. Four characters in a library, no stars, new director. It would probably be, screened and not in a theater, which is weird if you think about it.
Well, I think, in the real special, the Behind Closed Doors special that I did on the making of The Breakfast Club for NBC, you know, we've talked a lot about different people who were part of the film, and all of them kind of felt like, you know, John really did get pretty much most of the characters, the stereotypes. He got them pretty much spot on, because in high schools today, almost all of those still really exist. But I do think it would be a much more modern take, right? There'd have to be some diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything would be different because our culture is different now. And you would have to be way more representative than the John Hughes world was.
So in the years after the film, I mean, we all know the movie did great on VHS, then cable TV, regular TV. Do you remember seeing this movie on television all the time with the curses bleeped out?
Mm-hmm.
Just bury your head in the sand and wait for your fucking prom.
I think all those airing, I mean, we saw it as kids and stuff, as the years went on, and then all of a sudden DVDs players come out. Now we have it on DVD. I think, right, wasn't that a huge part of how the movie grew? Like the legacy of the movie started to build with all these other ways that you could see it. I mean, I think even the Library of Congress in 2016 actually like added it to its National Registry of Film. I mean, that tells you all you need to know.
It's in the Criterion Collection as well.
Yeah, that DVD release came out a few years ago.
And I think more and more people sort of grew up with this movie and then told their children about this movie. And I don't know many people who've never seen this movie. I mean, I ask my students, yeah. You know, I start showing it to them. They say, oh, yeah, I've seen it 30 times.
But it's a movie you can watch over and over. It is actually fairly short, considering the length that it started as, you know, John Hughes' original cut of 2.5 hours. It's like only 97 minutes. Like it's a fast read, as they say. But you can kind of pick up different things from it each time you see it, I feel like.
Well, and it has influences on so many different people and mediums. For example, one of my favorite movies is Dope. The director of the movie Dope considers The Breakfast Club to be one of its greatest influences. And this is an African-American comedy, basically, and an action picture. And he puts a Molly Ringwald joke, and I forget the sequence, but basically there's a fight and somebody throws something at somebody, and the guy goes, pulled a Molly Ringwald. I don't even know what that means.
It's funny.
But it was his homage to The Breakfast Club. Nice. So there's all these other influences that this movie has had in terms of how you do a character comedy with drama. And a lot of young directors go back looking at this movie it's gold star.
You know, Kevin Smith, Judd Apatow, these guys were saying they wouldn't have careers if it wasn't for these John Hughes movies.
The director of Dope, one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, and even John Singleton, Boys in the Hood. I mean, that's as far away as North Chicago suburbs as you can get. And they saw, and he related to those characters.
We were all pretty bizarre. Some of us are just better at hiding it, that's all.
Yeah, as the movie grew and you started to feel its influence, in 2005 for the 20th anniversary, the cast reunited for the MTV Movie Awards. And then in the 25th anniversary, they did something at the Paris Theater in New York. But the 30th anniversary, you know, back in 2015, that was a really special one. And I know you were really involved in that.
For the 30th anniversary, it was pretty cool because they did a digital remaster of the film. And they premiered it at South by Southwest. And Allie was there and Molly was there. And I was there. And they also re-released the film in 500 theaters for a month, the newly remastered film. And we all made some speeches. And we also did it in L.A., a huge park. We had a 30th anniversary.
Oh, yeah. I saw pictures of that. It looked amazing, actually.
It was like 5,000 people. And
so cool.
I was speaking to them from a microphone on the stage and everything. And they had cool T-shirts. And it was good. We sort of did a tour, a 30th anniversary tour around the country promoting the new version of the technically new version of the Breakfast Club. It was really exciting.
Yeah. Well, and there's lots of great photos of you on the red carpet with Ali Sheedy and Molly Ringwald. What were some of the questions you were getting on the red carpet, you know, about this movie 30 years later?
Well, it's sort of like this podcast. One question is always, why do you think this movie is relevant now? And my answer is, which we've been talking about, because it's universal to everybody in every generation, and everybody has the same insecurities and needs that are portrayed in this movie. And, you know, I think people at the 30th anniversary wanted to know if we were going to do a remake or a sequel, things like that. But it was mostly, why is it still relevant, and why do you think it's important? And that's been sort of the theme of what we've been talking about in these two podcasts.
I mean, picture yourself back in 1980, you know, two, standing in John Hughes' living room, and you probably were just shocked to even have a movie made, let alone get it in theaters. Now you're 30 years later talking about a movie that's so iconic. That must have been pretty validating for you, and really special.
So what people don't really think about, those of us who were there, is when we were making this movie 35 years ago, it was a little movie. It was not a big part of the Universal Picture catalog. We didn't know how many theaters we'd be in. We didn't know if we were going to open in two theaters and be gone. And we certainly, I mean, no one was saying, hey, who's doing the catering for the 30th anniversary of our premiere? I mean, no one was having that conversation.
That's funny. So,
30 years later, 35 years later, in retrospect, none of us expected the success that it had.
So that 30th anniversary in 2015, that was great that the movie got to be in theaters again and all that. And I'm sure there's going to be more anniversaries and more love. It's sad that John Hughes passed away in 2009. Do you have any thoughts about when you first learned that?
I think I was actually out of the country, but I heard, and it was in the news, that it was sort of, he was just taking a walk. I mean, it's a really sad story. And he has otherwise been healthy. You never know, but.
Yeah, it was a quick heart attack in New York City, and all of a sudden the world is robbed of this, you know, amazing voice. You know, he had been reclusive. He wasn't making films really at that time, of course. But no one's really been able to fill his shoes, right?
Well, I think people are trying. Judd Apatow is probably the closest one. But, you know, he was a unique brand. And the world is a better place because of him. And I've had a better life having met him and worked with him. And I think that's the best thing you can say about somebody, if they make the world a better place. Not only for you, but, you know, for society. Yeah. And I'm grateful to him for that. And all of us who worked with him are still grateful to him. Yeah.
And if, you know, if you want to get a little cheesy for a second, like, you indirectly made the world a better place by bringing that screenplay to the masses. How do you feel when you look back on it? How proud are you to be part of something so historical and so momentous?
Well, I'm proud of most of the movies I've made. There's a couple I'll take off that list. But I think The Breakfast Club was about something. And I've always thought my movies, when I'm working at, you know, my best level, should be about something. That it's not just a cheesy two-hour piece of entertainment and you walk out and you're not even thinking about it and you're texting somebody and it's like it never happened. With The Breakfast Club and Fried Green Tomatoes in a different kind of way. It's a movie that you think about, talk about, and, you know, we're doing podcasts about 35 years later, and you can't say that about many movies. I feel like, you know, if I can keep, even in my teaching, I always try to be about something and not just here's a quiz and read this book. And, you know, it's sort of my two primary drivers are instinct and being relevant and doing things that are meaningful to people. And I keep trying to do that every day.
Well, you're making
including
an impact.
Today.
Yeah, podcast, exactly. But you're making an impact in the classroom, certainly, with kids who are growing up with these films and studying them. So tell us when you started teaching at SCAD and when you started realizing, okay, I'm going to work in The Breakfast Club into my curriculum.
Well, I started teaching at SCAD in 2004. And I teach producing and I teach screenwriting. And I travel for SCAD a lot for admissions. And I found that sort of breaking the ice with students, telling them that I made the Breakfast Club sort of got their attention. You know, maybe they'd fall asleep later, but at least they wanted to know the story of how the Breakfast Club got made and fried green tomatoes. And it sort of gave me an into their world where, you know, I was a little bit cool, you know, probably not real cool, but a little bit if I made the Breakfast Club. So they'd give me another 20 minutes before they went on Facebook. And it's always been, for all the reasons we've been talking about, the way it opens, the three-act structure, the intensity of the talking head scene, the use of music as a character, the importance of editing in the film. It just gave me so many opportunities to talk about so many different things, not just the Breakfast Club, but screenwriting and directing and all of that. So it was a good door opener.
And you made a real impact with some of these films. Breakfast Club, really, for me, at the top of the list of movies that have changed our lives.
Sincerely yours, The Breakfast Club.
So thanks so much for tuning in to part two of the Making of The Breakfast Club podcast as part of the Meyer Chronicles. And if you haven't heard part one of The Making of The Breakfast Club, definitely check that out. Andy's got some great stories in there about how he first met John Hughes and how this movie really could have been totally different. So check out part one of The Making of The Breakfast Club. You are sure to learn stuff you never knew before. And keep your eyes and ears peeled for many more podcasts to come in this series.
And here's an audible fist bump.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Meyer Chronicles. And thank you for listening. To hear more episodes in this series, go to hotpiemedia.com.